You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
Now, we've now done 23 lessons in the book of Exodus, and we've covered the first 24 chapters. So, going about a chapter, a lesson on average, and we have 15 chapters left to go, or 16 chapters left to go from chapter 25 to 40. So that's the section we have left. And here in a couple of weeks, we're going to get into that. So we don't have an evening service on Easter Sunday. But then on April 16th, we'll be getting in and we'll be doing a couple chapters a chunk till we get through it. I should have it mapped out by that next point. But before we go back, it's been some time since we've been in Exodus, and so I thought it would be beneficial not only for you all, but also for me to go over what we already covered so that we sort of get in the zone of Exodus before we dive into the details. So this morning, I did something astonishing. I covered a whole chapter in one sermon, but tonight we are getting on the express train, and we are going to cover 24 chapters in one lesson. So you all need to buckle your seatbelts. And I'd encourage you, especially if you have a print Bible with you, which you should be bringing a print Bible to church, have it open and just flip through the pages. We're only going to read a few verses. We're not going to be able to read all 24 chapters. That would not, I don't even know if we could get that done in the time that we have. So we're not going to read over all the text. We're going to be sort of going over the big chunks and talking about the structure and sort of the big ideas that we've covered that we're going to build on as we get into the tabernacle section. So let's get our Bibles open. And after a few introductory things about the book of Exodus as a whole, we're going to be speeding through what we've covered up to this point. The overall dynamic of the book of Exodus is the movement from the forced service of building storehouses, mishkanot, for Pharaoh in Egypt, to the willing service of constructing a tabernacle, a mishkan, at the foot of Mount Sinai. The problem with Egyptian slavery wasn't that Israel was forced to work. We were created to work. We were created to serve. Service is what we were made for. So the fact that Israel was serving, that wasn't the problem. The problem was that they were serving on the wrong construction project, and they were serving the wrong master. And so Exodus begins, there's many things that are parallel about the structure of Exodus and the structure of Genesis, so we can't get into that tonight. Exodus begins with a foundational prologue in the first seven verses, and the rest of Exodus is divided into two unequal halves, from chapters 1 through 13 and chapters 14 through the end of the book in chapter 40. And we don't have time to work through all the arguments that I made for this structure at the beginning of the series, but these two panels, and this is why I call them panels, they work in parallel, often strikingly so. And so basically, you have one panel, and it goes from the beginning to the end, and then you have the other panel that is like this panel, like blown up. How many of you have seen those old-style projectors where you'd put a transparency and it would project up onto the wall? So when I was growing up, my dad used those all the time. And so what you have is you put the page, usually just a standard 8.5 by 11 page, and then it gets blown up larger. But the larger blow up reflects what you have on the smaller page, plus whatever changes are made by the projector itself, if there happens to be a scratch on the lens, for example. And so certainly there's no scratches in the book of Exodus. But what we see with this second panel is that it's like a blow up of that first panel. And so there's many connections to the same points between these two panels. And we'll just note a few of those. And each panel, though, comes to an end. There's this bookmark. There's only two places in the book of Exodus where it talks about the people of God being led by the pillar of cloud and fire. And so at the end of chapter 13, you come to that point. And that language gets repeated at the end of chapter 40. And so when the Old Testament was written, they didn't have things like chapters or title pages or tables of contents. All of those are recent inventions, headers, all of these things that we take for granted, verse numbers. And so one of the ways that text would be structured is by paralleling things like this, the repetition of key elements. And we'll see that quite a bit as we go through tonight. So in the first panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered from service to Pharaoh. And in the second panel of the book, we see how Israel was prepared for service to the Lord. So if you can keep this in mind, this tale of two building projects, it'll help you get a handle on the overall message of the book. The central theme of the book of Exodus, it's this tale of two building projects, a tale that contrasts the rebellious human desire to build the city and tower of Babel with a covenantal promise to restore the garden sanctuary. As we've seen, these two panels run in parallel, and there are many links between them. And so, now we are ready to begin journeying through these first 24 chapters. First, we have the prologue. First seven verses provide the prologue to the rest of the book. And in a number of ways, the language of this prologue intentionally ties the story of Exodus into the story of Genesis. The book of Exodus in Hebrew begins with the word "and." It's a continuation of what we find in Genesis. And there are many links, intricate links, between this prologue and what has already happened. Despite all the barren women, weak husbands, and all the other obstacles to the seed of the woman that we saw throughout the course of Genesis, the promises of God are beginning to see some initial fulfillment. God's creational agenda is being fulfilled in the sons of Israel. They're being fruitful and they're multiplying. But they're in the wrong place and they're serving the wrong master. And the seed of the serpent has begun to war against the seed of the woman. So that's the setup. The setup, you got to see this. The setup is that God's promise that the woman would have a seed is being fulfilled. But the serpent is still on the attack. And the serpent has taken the form of a Pharaoh who does not know Joseph. Section 1. Section 1 is from 1:8 after the prologue through the end of chapter 2. So chapters 1 and 2 is the first section of the first panel. In 1:8 through 1:22, with the rest of chapter 1, we get three rounds of Pharaoh's anti-creational wisdom. Pharaoh increasingly sets himself against the promises of God. God told his people, God told Abraham, I'm going to make you exceedingly numerous. I'm going to make you fruitful and multiplied. And Pharaoh says, no, I don't want none of that fruitfulness and multiplication. I'm going to put a stop to it. So this is the fulfillment of God's creational promise. And Pharaoh's at war against it. He doesn't want that. And so we have this setup of Pharaoh versus creation. This is really important for understanding what's going on in Exodus. Not only that, but when Pharaoh is enslaving the children of Israel, he's making them labor in brick and mortar. It's a key tie-in to the Tower of Babel. There's a connection between the project of the Tower of Babel and project of Pharaoh's store cities. Pharaoh is a modern-day builder of the Tower of Babel. He set himself against creation. He set himself against God's covenantal purposes. So what's God going to do about this? Well, he's going to come down and mix things up a bit, just like he did back in Genesis chapter 11, where we have the story of the Tower of Babel. So in chapter 2, we get the story of the birth and upbringing of Moses. Moses is rescued from Pharaoh's slaughter, but Moses goes on to demonstrate that he's unable to rescue God's people from under Pharaoh's hand. As will happen to Israel in this first section of the second panel. Remember I said how there's these connections? So when we get to the first section of the second panel, we find that Israel is delivered through the water of the sea. The sea? What sea? Red Sea. And they're brought into what? After they pass through the Red Sea, where do they find themselves? In the what? No, not immediately. Where are they right after the Red Sea? Petey? They're in the wilderness. And where do they end up after the wilderness? They travel through the wilderness and they arrive at a particular place. Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And so, in this first section of the first panel, we find that Moses is delivered through water. He's brought into the wilderness, and he arrives at the mountain of God. Right? These are the kinds of connections that I'm talking about. What happens to Moses in the first panel happens to Israel in the second panel. And so Moses has been rescued, but Moses is very far from being able to rescue anyone. At the very mention that Pharaoh might find out what he's been up to, Moses runs away. And so here's the setup in this. We have the first section, and the drama has intensified. Because here Pharaoh has set himself against the creational purposes of God. And Pharaoh has servants, he has taskmasters, he's enslaved the whole nation of Israel, he has people who are doing what he wants, the seed of the serpent seems to be winning. And who's serving God? Who's accomplishing God's purposes? Now Moses, he's run away. Who is going to be God's servant? Because that's the theme. Who are you going to serve? And what project are you going to serve on? So that wraps out the first section. And the next section directly addresses this question. Who is going to speak for God? Who is going to rescue God's people? Who is going to stand against the serpent? Chapter 3 through chapter 6 gives us the second section of the first panel. And in this section, the Lord appears to Moses on the mountain of God, and he consecrates him as his messenger to Israel. In this second section, from chapter 3 to chapter 6, the Lord appears to Moses on the mountain of God and consecrates him as his messenger to Israel. Now, this section, chapter 3 through chapter 6, it begins with God speaking to Moses in the wilderness, and then there's a wrap. This is how I divided these sections out, because there's these clear clues in the text. It starts with God giving Moses a message on Mount Sinai, and then it ends with God giving Moses the same message in Egypt. Moses is being consecrated as God's messenger. In chapters 3 through 4, the Lord meets Moses at the mountain of God, and he commissions him to deliver his people from slavery. Moses will be God's answer to Pharaoh's anti-creational agenda. Moses is the seed of the woman who will take on the seed of the serpent in this story. But Moses isn't sure that he's cut out for the job. First, he asks a round of questions. Who am I that you should send me? God tells him, I picked you. And then he says, who are you, God? So God answers him. Having responded graciously to Moses' questions and concerns, God formally tells him to go to Egypt. So it's very important. God comes to Moses. Moses asks questions. God is gracious in response. Then God tells him to go. And then after he's already been told what to do, he starts raising objections. And that's when he starts getting into trouble. Once he's been told what to do and raises objections after that, well, then things are a little different. So Moses has three objections. They won't believe me. So God gives him three signs. He gives him a rod that turns into a serpent, a hand that becomes leprous and then becomes healed again, and water that turns into blood. Then he says, I can't do it. And God says, I'll be with you. You will do it. And finally, Moses says what basically amounts to, God, will you pick somebody else? And that's when he gets in trouble. And he has no more excuses left. And so, reluctantly, he ends up going. The children of Israel believe the signs, and it seems like things are going to go well. In chapter 5, however, we discover that Moses and Aaron's first confrontation with Pharaoh doesn't go particularly well. So God had given very specific instructions, and Moses and Aaron don't listen to God's instructions. They try to do it their own way, and predictably, it doesn't go well. Far from letting the people go, Pharaoh only increases their labors. And so it looks like, okay, here's the way it looks, right? That you have the seed of, you have the creational promises going forward. You have the seed of the serpent who sets himself against the creational promises. And it looks like God has shot his bolt and failed. He picked Moses, and Moses confronted Pharaoh. And Pharaoh hasn't changed. And Moses is quavering and trembling and feeling like a failure. So what's God going to do? Well, he's going to do exactly what he said he was going to do. He's going to rescue his people from Pharaoh, the serpent king, who doesn't know what's about to happen. Pastor John, could you fix this? It's doing something that is driving me crazy. It's like going back and something is, it's like flickering back and forth with something. So, after this not very inspiring start, the Lord once again appears to Moses and repeats his commissioning. Moses, unlikely as it feels to him or looks to others, is God's man to take on Pharaoh. And so this brings us to our third section in the first panel, in which Pharaoh's agenda begins to unravel. So, section 3. Thank you so much. It was driving me a bit batty. Section 3 goes from chapter 7 through chapter 11, and it's the unraveling of Pharaoh's anti-creational agenda. So, in this third section, from chapter 7 through chapter 11, we see the anti-creational store city building agenda of Pharaoh start to unravel as God strikes 10 decreational blows against Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Pharaoh's building projects, dependent on the slave labor of the children of Israel, are as doomed as the Tower of Babel. They don't stand a chance. Now, up to this point in the Exodus story, God has made a lot of promises, but he's not actually done much of anything. The power of Pharaoh was obvious. The power of the Lord, not so much as yet. And this has ratcheted up the tension. It's raised the question, is the Lord just a paper tiger? Is he unable to deal with Pharaoh's anti-creational building project? Up to this point in the story, you might well wonder that. Because all God has done is talk. And Pharaoh looks like he's in charge. You have to feel the tension you come into this with to feel the awe of what God does to Pharaoh. The humiliation of Pharaoh seems obvious to us who, most of us, grew up aware of how this story turns out. But when it was happening, it was not at all obvious how it was going to turn out. Pharaoh was the big cheese, and God was the one who no one knew if they could trust. Well, God's about to change that, and in a dramatic way. In this third section, all this changes dramatically. Pharaoh, the Egyptians, and God's own people learn something about who the Lord really is from what he does in the world. So we've come to chapter 7. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 13, it gives the showdown between Aaron's rod snake and the rod snakes of the Egyptian magicians. And it provides a prelude to the 10 plagues, more literally, the 10 blows, the 10 strikes that follow. And Pharaoh has now had his last warning. He and his people will not and cannot escape the 10 blows of God's judgment that are about to fall on them and reverse the situation in which the people of God found themselves. Now, we can't go through the 10 blows in detail this evening, but there are two things it'd be helpful to point out in this overview. First, throughout the 10 blows, there runs a clear theme of decreation. So we have to get this theme of creation is so central to the book of Exodus. Because first, Israel is fulfilling God's creational agenda, and then Pharaoh has set himself against creation. And God is going to give his created order, its revenge on the one who dared to set himself against it. Because Pharaoh has set himself against God's creational agenda for his people, God proceeds to undo the creational order for him. It's fascinating. The creation account has creatures created in the seas, in the earth, and in the air. And all three of these domains are affected by God's judgment on Pharaoh. There's judgment that comes out of the sea, there's judgment that takes place on the ground, and there's judgment that comes from the air. Furthermore, there's a second aspect of this, there's a clear theme of the undoing of the creational order, the progressive undoing of the creational order in these blows. So first the fish die. Now fish are under man's dominion, but we don't really have much to do with the wild fish that swim in the river. They're not really under our control very much. But then the pests get out of control from the water, from the dirt, and from the air. So now the animals aren't just dying, they're going to war against humans. Then the cattle, the domesticated animals, the ones that are directly the sign of our dominion over creation, they all start to die. And finally, vegetation, the primary food of man, what God had originally given him for food in the garden is destroyed. Here's what's happening. Each of the areas of which man was originally given dominion in the creation is systematically being destroyed and removed from under his control. And to get ahead of ourselves for a little bit, it's no surprise that the last of the plagues is the taking away of light, which is the beginning of creation. And then after the 10 plagues, we have a separation, and we come to the Red Sea, and the Spirit of God moves on the waters, and it takes us back to Genesis 1:1 before the sequence of 7 days. And creation is utterly taken away from Pharaoh. There's also a significance to the number 10. While there are 7 days to the creation account in Genesis, 6 days of creation, and then a 7th day of rest, there are actually, as has often been noted, this is not original to me by any extent at all, there are 10 times that God speaks in the account of Genesis 1. 10 times that God says, 10 times that the Hebrew phrase, Vayomer Elohim, and God said, appears. These are sometimes called the 10 words of creation, or as one commentator put it, the 10 divine utterances by which the world was created and ordered. It's almost certainly not a coincidence that when God does the order of creation for Pharaoh, he does so with 10 divine blows. And when Israel is constituted as a nation around Mount Sinai, the foundation is 10 divine utterances that we know as the 10 commandments. That sequencing is intentional. And what we call the 10 commandments in the Old Testament are always referred to as the 10 words, not the 10 commandments. And this ties into that same theme. Secondly, and more briefly, there's a clear patterning to the blows. Without going into the details, the 10 have clearly been arranged into 3 sets of 3, which is a careful structure to this, followed by a final climactic blow that takes place in the 3 sets of 3, followed by a final climactic blow. So in the first cycle, the first set of 3, we have the Nile turned into blood, frogs come out of the Nile, and lice comes out of the dust. And in this first group of 3, all of them affect God's people as well as the Egyptians. But starting with the second people, God's people are spared and only the Egyptians are struck. Flies fill the air, plague kills the cattle, and then you have skin sores on man and beast. And in the third cycle, you have hail and lightning, locust and darkness. While we don't have time to make the creational connection that are present in most of the other blows, there's all these connections in language, vocabulary, the way things are described, all of which goes back to Genesis 1 and 2 over and over again. And of course, we worked through that when we worked through these chapters earlier in the series, and all of that's online if you want to listen to that. But this brings us now to the 4th section of the first panel. So section 1, we find Moses delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai. Section 2, the Lord appears to Moses on the mountain of God and consecrates him as his messenger to Israel. Section 3, we find the unraveling of Pharaoh's anti-creation agenda. Pharaoh looks supremely competent and powerful at the beginning, but by the end, God has humiliated Pharaoh. And the Egyptians know who God is. And they know who's boss. Section 4, chapter 12, 1 through 28, we have the Feast of Passover and Unleavened Bread. And this Feast of Passover and the final blow, the 10th and climactic blow that comes along with it, this separates the people of God from the Egyptians. In this 4th section, the people of God are separated from the Egyptians by the Feast of Passover and the 10th and final blow in which all the firstborn of the Egyptians are killed, while the firstborn of the children of Israel are spared through the application of blood to the doorpost. Section 5, the Exodus is accomplished and the people are led by fire and cloud. In the 5th and final section of the first panel, the Exodus is actually accomplished and the people are led by fire and cloud. In the entirety of the book of Exodus, there's only one other reference to the cloud by day and the fire by night. And this reference comes at the very end of the book, at the conclusion of the 2nd panel. As we come to the end of this 1st panel, God has delivered Israel from service to the anti-creational agenda of Pharaoh. Just as the 1st half of Genesis deals with the origin of the nations, while the 2nd half zoomed in to deal with the origin of Israel, so also in Exodus, the 1st half deals with how God works to judge the nation that was oppressing his people, and the 2nd half deals with how God worked to shape the people that he intended to proclaim his glory. So that's the 1st panel of the book of Exodus. Any questions up to this point? Of course, we're going at whirlwind speed, but any questions that have occurred to you all? Anyone? All right. We'll get into the 2nd panel. The 2nd panel, from chapter 14 to chapter 40, The Lord enables Israel to serve him by the building of the tabernacle. So we have the undoing of Pharaoh's construction project, and then we have the Lord's construction project is central to this second panel. So in the first section, what happened to Moses now happens to Israel. Israel is delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai. Delivered through the very waters of the Red Sea that Pharaoh intended to use to trap and destroy them, they were led into the wilderness to be tested before being brought to the foot of the mountain of God. In other words, what happened to Moses is now happening to Israel. And so chapters 14 through 15 tell the story of God's final victory over Pharaoh. I got a little bit ahead of myself, but as we remember the decreational theme that has run through God's conflict with Pharaoh, it's striking that the final judgment comes by the wind or spirit. In Hebrew, it's very important to understand that wind and spirit are the same word. It's the word ruach. Wind, spirit, same word. So when we read in Genesis 1 that the Spirit of God is moving upon the face of the waters, and we read in Exodus 14 that the wind is dividing the waters, it's the same idea. And it's striking that the final judgment comes by the wind or the Spirit of God once again moving upon the face of the waters. And the waters that were divided from the waters are no longer divided from the waters, but they're brought back together again. Pharaoh has set himself against creation, and so he is consumed by chaos. And that is where our society is headed today, by the way. We cannot set ourselves against the creational order and expect to be sustained by that same creational order. Reality gets the last word. And if we set ourselves against God's creation order, we will be destroyed. That's what Pharaoh found out. And that's what the seed of the serpent in America is about to find out. Our power will go down if we continue in the path that we are headed down as a country. So this finishes the decreational process of judgment for Pharaoh. And so it represents the final undoing of creation for Pharaoh, but it also represents the beginning, and this is why it begins the second panel, because it's the beginning of a new creation for the children of Israel. So Pharaoh, the old creation, he set himself against it, he's destroyed. But God is creating his people anew, and so a process of new creation is beginning. And it's striking that salvation in the new covenant is described as a new creation. And in salvation, we once again, so when you have the crossing of the Red Sea, you have Moses holding up a wooden staff over the waters, and you have the wind coming and dividing the waters. Well, our salvation is described as a new creation. And we have Christ bringing the cross, the tree, literally, the tree of judgment, and holding it over the waters of judgment, and the Spirit of God blowing on our hearts. It's a picture of the new creation, and it's a reason why you have these connections between creation and the rescue at the Red Sea, and of course, it's why the rescue at the Red Sea becomes the paradigm for salvation over and over again in the New Testament. These things are connected. In salvation, we once again have the waters of judgment parted by wood and by wind, the wood of Christ's cross and the wind of the Spirit, just as happened at the first Exodus. This great deliverance at the Red Sea. So we are in the first section of the second panel. And this great deliverance at the Red Sea, chapters 14 tells the story. Chapter 15 tells that same story in song. And then we get into the wilderness. And there's three tests on the way to Sinai that take place in chapter 16 and 17. You have bitter water at Marah, no food in the wilderness of Sin, and no water in Rephidim. Three tests. Who else was tested three times in the wilderness? Jesus was. And it is no accident that Jesus was tested three times in the wilderness, because Israel faced three tests in the wilderness. And yet where Israel as a nation failed, Israel as a person, the servant of the Lord who summed up the nation in himself, he stood and succeeded. So having now covered the three tests of God in the wilderness on the way to Sinai, we are now told of two interactions with the people of that wilderness, one profoundly negative and one wonderfully positive. So first, in 8 through 16, we have war with Amalek. So in this first section of the second panel, we have Israel is delivered from Pharaoh. Wonderful. Then Israel is tested in the wilderness. Then Israel deals with the people of the wilderness. First, there's a war with Amalek, who are a sort of band of desert pirates who try to prey on them when they're weary from the journey. Then in chapter 18, we have the visit of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. Now, for reasons I explain when we work through it in detail, chapter 18 is most likely placed here in terms of thematically rather than strictly chronologically. We sometimes assume that all the narratives of the Old Testament are precisely chronological. Well, we don't always tell stories that way, and certainly the Old Testament stories don't work that way. Often things are arranged by their theme. And the theme by which these stories 17 and 18 are arranged is that you have two contrasting ways of dealing with outsiders. And so that is what is there in chapter 18. So that wraps out the first section of the second panel. And this brings us to the second section of the second panel, which is where we spent the bulk of our time in our previous survey, because it's so central. Chapters 19 through 24. So remember, in the second section of the first panel, what happened? Anyone? So in the first panel, what happens in the second section? Chapters 3 through 6 of Exodus. What happens there?
Lord appears to Moses.
And he consecrates him as a messenger to go back and free his people. So, in section 2, in the second panel, the Lord appears to Israel on the mountain of God, same place, and he consecrates Israel as his messenger to the nations. He consecrates Israel as his messenger to the nations. This section, chapters 19 through 24, is absolutely central, not only to both the book and the message of Exodus, but to the Old Testament as a whole. These chapters, as Moses himself describes them in 24:7, form the book of the covenant, what Jeremiah and the New Testament refer to as the Old Covenant. The covenant that was replaced by the new covenant. And it's rightly been said that almost all denominational differences among Christians at some level go back to differing ways of understanding chapters 19 through 24 of Exodus and how the New Testament relates to them. And so we spent quite a bit of time working through those details because they're important. So in chapter 19, the covenant is introduced. In chapter 20, we find the 10 words, often referred to as the 10 commandments. And then in chapters 21 through 23, we have a collection of specific judgments. So the old covenant is formed of words and judgments. That's what the old covenant is made up of. And then in 19, we have the introduction. And then in 24, we have the covenant being ratified. So in 19, 3 through 8, we find the purpose of the covenant God was about to cut with Israel. Now, we haven't taken the time to read many verses in this whirlwind overview, but I can't skip over these. We're going to read 19, 3 through 8. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now, therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, All that the Lord hath spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord. Now, there are two things we need to observe about these verses. First, the language of peculiar treasure is the language of sonship. It's sonship language. Already, not coincidentally, in the second section of the first panel, Israel has been described in Exodus 4 as God's firstborn son. So this idea that Israel as a nation is God's son has already been introduced to us. And as one writer put it, when the Lord calls Israel to be his personal treasure, that is his peculiar treasure in the King James, he is speaking of the kind of devoted service given by a son. That's what we learn in Malachi from one of the only other uses of this term. We are back here to the divine image in Genesis 1:26 through 28. Israel has inherited an Adamic role, giving the devoted service of a son and honored king in a covenant relationship. In other words, the purpose of the Sinai covenant was for Israel to serve as the son and the servant of the Lord. As Isaiah makes so clear, Israel was chosen out from among the nations to be a light to those nations, to be the son and the servant of the Lord. Just as Moses was commissioned on the mountain to be his agent for delivering Israel, so Israel is being called on this same mountain to be God's agent for delivering the nations. So that's the first thing. This is sonship language. Israel is being commissioned as the son and the servant, the obedient son who's going to represent God, as Adam was called to represent God. The people who is going to bear God's name, as we in our day bear through baptism God's name. Second, this is the first time in the book of Exodus that Israel has been described as a nation. There's an organization, that not only a commissioning that is taking place, there's also an organization of Israel from a group of random people to an organized nation that's taking place here at Mount Sinai. As the former slaves gather around Mount Sinai, God promises to turn them into a nation. And the rest of chapter 19 sets the stage for the revelation of the 10 words, often called the 10 commandments, that we find in chapter 20. As the people prepare for God to descend, Mount Sinai is divided into three zones of holiness. So you have the top of the mountain that is most holy, where God comes down. You have the rest of the mountain that is holy, that only those who have been properly ordained and prepared can go up to. And then you have the base of the mountain where all the people are gathered. What does that remind you of? Temple. And in the book of Exodus? The tabernacle. So in the tabernacle, you have three zones of holiness. You have the Holy of Holies, where only the high priest can enter. You have the holy place where the priests do their work. And then you have the broader courtyard where the Israelites come to worship God. The tabernacle is a portable Mount Sinai and is explicitly portrayed as such in the text. When we get in the tabernacle, sometimes you might think, and I've heard people say, well, all this stuff about the tabernacle, what are all these boring instructions about? Well, I have a treat for you. They're not boring at all. There is a lot going on in the building of the tabernacle. The tabernacle is a miniature Mount Sinai. And it's also a miniature Garden of Eden. The point of the tabernacle is the restoration of creation to its original intended purpose. So there are so many. So this whole theme, this is what we're going to see. This whole theme of decreation and judgment and anti-creation of Pharaoh is matched, it's mirrored by the restoration of creation through the organized worship of God that centers around the construction of the tabernacle. God's building project is the answer to Pharaoh's building project. That's the story of Exodus. Chapter 20, we come to the 10 words. As I mentioned earlier, it's significant that the 10 blows of decreation against Pharaoh are paralleled by 10 words of recreation for Israel. And though standard orderings sometimes miss it, these 10 words divide evenly into two groups of five. Now, in the Gospels, Jesus sums up the 10 words into two great commandments, Matthew 22 and verse 37. Jesus said unto him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. And so Jesus summarizes the law, love God, love your neighbor. Two great commandments. Well, the 10 words that we know as the 10 commandments break evenly into five words that deal with the love of God and five words that deal with the love of neighbor. It's no accident that each of the first five words And only the first five words make specific reference to the Lord thy God. Each of them says the Lord thy God five times, and then it doesn't get mentioned at all in the next five. That's not accidental. That's telling us how to divide the 10 words. Furthermore, the first five words and only the first five words are each given a specific explanation, while the last five words are presented without an explanation or a motivation clause. So, we have the five words that deal with the first great commandment. The first deals with who to worship. God does not share his power with anyone. He tolerates no other gods in his presence. Because God has all the power, we should worship him alone. The second word deals with how to worship. God cannot be manipulated by the means that the false gods of the nations are manipulated by. His people are neither to fashion any sort of idol for themselves, nor to participate in any way in the idolatrous worship of the nations. The third word forbids the children of Israel to bear the Lord's name in vain. Just as the Lord's name was placed on them, so also has been placed on each of us through our baptism into the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. In everything that we do, we are to remember that the Lord's name has been placed upon us and to live our lives accordingly. That's the third word. The fourth word deals with the Sabbath day, the sign that shaped the lives and structured the weeks of the Old Covenant people of God. Now, we are no longer under the Old Covenant. Jesus has given, does give, and will give us the reality of rest towards which the sign of the Sabbath could only point. Furthermore, we ourselves have been given a new covenant sign in the Lord's table, a sign of remembrance and anticipation. The same two themes that were present in the Sabbath are present in the explanations that are given of the Lord's table. A sign that is to structure our week, just as the Sabbath structured there, as we gather for the worship of the Lord on his day. So that's the fourth word. And the fifth word deals with the importance of honoring parents as an example of all the humans to whom God has delegated some of his own authority. In other words, the direct relationship we have with God does not destroy or remove our obligation to the delegated authorities that he has placed in our life. When we disrespect the authorities that God has put in place, we disrespect God. That's why this fifth word goes with love for God rather than love for neighbor. Because it's not actually about your parents or your political leaders or your pastors. It's about the God who put those authorities in place and what you think of him. Our devotion to God is not to cause us to ignore or to fail to submit to the authorities and institutions that God has set up. Worshiping God is never just about me and God doing our thing. It's about the structures that God has put in place and by which his world is ordered. God is a God of order. That's the first great commandment, and we have five words that deal with that. Then we come to the second great commandment, and we have five words that deal with love of neighbor. In a tightly condensed form, they spell out what it means to love our neighbors as ourselves. So, the sixth word is this: never kill. Don't violate your neighbor's person. Now, the Hebrew word that's translated in some translations as thou shalt not kill and in others as thou shalt not murder is a really tricky word, because our English word for kill is too broad and our English word for murder is too narrow. Now, the Hebrew word is right in between those two. It refers very specifically to any killing of humans by humans that doesn't have divine authorization. That's what's being prohibited. Any killing of humans by humans that doesn't have divine authorization. So that's what's being prohibited. So don't violate your neighbor's person. Don't violate your neighbor's home by committing adultery against him. Don't steal. Don't take your neighbor's possessions. Don't both bear false witness. Don't take your neighbor's justice or reputation. And finally, never covet. And this brings us to really the summary of this whole matter. We're to love our neighbor as ourselves. We're to seek our neighbor's good positively. So those are the 10 words. Any questions up to this point before we move on? Haven't paused for a little bit. Gavin.
So a while back, you mentioned when talking about Pharaoh basically going against the creational order, mm-hmm. You referred to America going against America's creational order. Could you expound on that a little more?
Well, I wouldn't say America's creation order, just the creation order. So our rejection of divine roles for men and women, our rejection of the givenness of even biological sex as such. So basically, like, we are our rejection of fertility as a creational good. So all of the things that Pharaoh was against, our nation has set itself against and is exporting all over the world. So we are exporting our madness in a very significant way. So it's not so much that, you know, we're set, you know, that America's order is creational in some sense, but just the order of creation, you know, the order of what work is, of how we grow things, like just at every level, all the way down to the details. But the biggest example would be homosexuality and transgenderism to an even greater extent. That is a flat out declaration of war against God's purposes for creation in a way that's even more flagrant than Pharaoh. And so I expect our judgment to be even more striking than the one that Pharaoh got. We're like beyond Sodom and Gomorrah. So this is not going to end well for us. Anyone else? Petey?
How were the Egyptian magicians also able to perform the same stuff that Moses and Aaron did?
Well, they didn't all the way down. But I would say the clear indication of the text is that they had real power from the devil. And so the devil tries. The serpent has real power. And he tries to do various things. And ultimately, he can't hold a candle to the power of God. And so I'd say the devil really does have power in this world. But God's power is greater. The devil can turn rods into snakes. But God's snake stick can eat their snake sticks. Gobble them up. And, you know, I think one of the things we're going to see, like, our culture is embracing the demonic astonishingly quickly. And at the one level, that's terrifying. But at another level, God's power and Satan's power are not comparable. So if we're going to do a showdown, we know who's going to win. So we should not be afraid and cringe in terror at the thought that the devil could be at work. The devil's always at work. But God's power is always greater, and the cross will triumph. So let's be prepared to stand in the power of Jesus' name. Andrew? Or are you just holding the microphone? Anyone else? Okay. So we're in this second section of the second panel, chapters 19 through 24, this crucially important section. So chapter 19 is telling us about the foundation, the purpose of the covenant. Chapter 20 gives us the 10 words, and then it has a little bit of a transition. And then in chapter 21 through 23, we find the judgments. After the 10 words spoken directly by God from the top of the mountain, in chapter 20 and chapter 21 through 23, we find a large assortment of particular judgments or rules or regulations, depending on the translation you're using. Now, these judgments certainly form a very diverse list. They range from the punishment of kidnappers to the responsibility of the owners of aggressive oxen. We had a fun time with that when we worked through it before, dealing with the pushing oxen. As it turns out, pushing oxen is like the favorite topic of ancient Near Eastern law codes, where you're going to, this is like all the ancient Near Eastern lawyers' favorite thing to talk about. What do you do with the pushing oxen? Here's how you know. Here's what's on the final exam dealing with pushing oxen. So that, of course, shows up in the law code in the Old Covenant as well. To the care of orphans, to the prohibition of boiling a young goat in its mother's milk. By no means comprehensive, they are very particular, and they deal with the everyday realities of life as it was lived at that time. So the 10 words are these general principles that apply at all times and in all situations, and then, as it were, the text gets down to the nitty-gritty in dealing with the judgments. So there's a few sections, a few smaller sections within chapters 21 through 23. First, in 21:1 through 22:20, we find legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of different situations. Here's where we find the pushing oxen and the kid boy, the pushing oxen and a lot of these different particular details. And the point of this collection of judgments isn't to provide a comprehensive overview of all possible situations, but rather to provide wisdom by explaining what to do in cases that illustrate the various principles by which judgment was to be made. So these are illustrative examples. It's not a comprehensive, here's what to do here, here's what to do here, here's what's to do here. It's rather, consider this situation and learn wisdom. Consider this situation and learn wisdom. Consider this situation and learn wisdom. And throughout all of the details, which of course we're not going to review tonight, there are two central themes. One is even-handed justice. So if you take it all down and you say, what wisdom are we supposed to take from this? What wisdom were they supposed to take from this? The first one is even-handed justice. There would be no carve-outs for the rich and powerful. There was to be no abuse of the system by the well-connected. And there was to be a balance and penalty between compensation to the one who has been wronged and deterrence to the one who would do the wrong. So there's a need both to deter future acts of injustice, but also to provide compensation to those against whom injustice had been committed. So this theme of even-handed justice runs throughout all of these examples. And second, there's a theme of the sanctity of life. All human life is valued, even those human lives that society at the time did not deem to be particularly valuable, like the lives of slaves or young children. Certainly, our culture could learn a lesson from that. So all human life is valued, and second, crimes against life are treated as fundamentally different from crimes against property, which was a shocking idea in that day and time. And so in 21:1 through 22:20, we find legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of situations. Then in 22:21 through 23:9, we have the next section here, and that is moral imperatives in every situation. And there's three moral imperatives that always apply. Compassion for the vulnerable, respect for God, and justice for all. Compassion on the vulnerable, respect for God, and justice for all. So these are the moral imperatives that are to guide us at all times. And then finally, in this section, we have the rhythms of life as illustrated by the festivals. We have rhythms of work and rest, rhythms of respect for the Lord, and rhythms of consumption and restraint. That's where we find the kid boiled in its mother's milk. And when you look at the context and you look at the structure, you can understand that this famously mysterious commandment is dealing with the reality that there is to be restraint in our consumption, even when we're engaging in a festival. And then 23 ends with some instructions for the occupation of the land of Canaan. So you have 19, you have the setup for the covenant, and then the covenant composed of two parts, the 10 words in chapter 20, and the judgments in chapters 21 through 23. And then in chapter 24, you get to that point where the covenant is ratified. That is what we've covered up to this point. We've covered up to this point the first panel, and its five sections, and the first two sections of the second panel. So we have three sections left to go. Section 3, 25 through 31, is the unveiling of God's creation-restoring agenda. In the third section of the first panel, we saw how God stopped the creation-destroying building agenda of Pharaoh. In the third section of the second panel, we see the creation-restoring building agenda of God. So the building of the tabernacle is God's positive response to what Pharaoh was up to. Pharaoh was building. God smashes Pharaoh's building project. He derails it completely. But God doesn't just destroy what Pharaoh was up to. God has a building project of his own. And we're given instructions for that building project in 25 through 31. We're given instructions for the building of the tabernacle. God is supremely concerned that he be worshipped according to his instructions. That is the most important thing in the world. That is the ultimate thing that had gone wrong in Egypt, and that is what had to be put to right for creation to be restored. Because the worship of God is the center of reality. It's why there is something rather than nothing. And if you make anything else the center, you will lose whatever you set up as an idol. whatever you set up as an idol, however good it is in and of itself, you will consume it, and it will consume you, and you will be left completely destroyed. The center of creation is the worship of God. And that's why so much attention is given to the precise instructions for the building of the tabernacle. As we'll begin to see next time, the tabernacle is not only a portable Mount Sinai, it is also a miniature Garden of Eden in which and by which the original purposes of creation begin to be restored. So that section 3 is the unveiling of God's creation restoring agenda, and that matches the destruction of Pharaoh's creation opposing agenda. Then we find section 4 in the second panel. So what did we find in section 4 of the first panel? We found Passover. The Passover is a
annual event.
Yes, but it's a, what is it?
Feast.
It's a feast. The Passover is a feast. So what do we find in the fourth section of the second panel? We find
feast.
We find a feast. And this feast, the first feast, the Passover, separates the people of God from the Egyptians. This second feast, the anti-feast of the golden calf, separates those who are on the Lord's side from those who are opposed to the Lord. It has the same function, only within the nation now. Both the feast of the Passover and the feast of the golden calf claim to be feasts to the Lord, yet one resulted in deliverance and the other resulted in judgment. And then the final section, the tabernacle is constructed, and the people are led by fire and cloud. So the third section of the first panel, you had the nine plagues, you had the 10 plagues, which unraveled Pharaoh's agenda, right? Then you have the Feast of Passover, and then you have the final, you have the nine plagues, the Feast of Passover, and the final plague. So you have this separation between the basic unraveling of Pharaoh and the final destruction of Pharaoh, and it's separated by a feast. Well, when you get to the end of Exodus in the second panel, you find exactly the same thing. You have instructions. Here's how the tabernacle is to be built. Then you have the feast of the golden calf. And then you have the tabernacle actually built. So you have that same pattern of how God is basically undoing, unraveling Pharaoh's plans, and then finally smashing Pharaoh. Well, you have the same pattern in reverse, that God is giving instructions for the building of the tabernacle. And then, after a pause that deals with the feast, you have the actual tabernacle constructed, and the glory cloud descends and fills the tabernacle. And God is present with his people as the beginning of the restoration of creation. That is a survey of the book of Exodus at high speed. Any questions? If we have no more questions about Exodus, we can take a few questions about other things, should you have any general questions. But any questions about Exodus before we wrap that up? Going once, twice. Sweetheart.
The parallel of Moses and Israel being delivered, but the wording of Moses being delivered through water, I've never really thought of. Is that just so the parallels match well? Or because he was kind of delivered from water, right?
Well, he was delivered by being placed in the Nile River. So just the idea that there is water. So that's just my phrasing, that he's delivered, though. He's delivered by coming into the water and being rescued out of it. So they throw him into the water, and yet he's not destroyed by the water. And so in a similar, I think if I develop that more, I would say he's put into that which should destroy him, and yet through God's providence, it doesn't destroy him. So he's put into the Nile River where the boys were to be thrown to their destruction. And yet he is not destroyed, but instead he's delivered. And the same thing happens with the children of Israel, and that they are put, you know, their backs are up to the Red Sea. So the Red Sea should have been that which destroyed them. But instead, because of God's providential and miraculous working in their case, they are in fact delivered through that very thing and their enemies. So it's that water is being used to turn the tables. So Pharaoh thinks the Nile River is going to destroy the Hebrew babies, but actually the Nile River is what God uses to save Moses. And Pharaoh thinks, again, that the Red Sea, this is a different Pharaoh, but it's still Pharaoh, thinks that the Red Sea is going to destroy the children of Israel because their backs are up to the water and they have no hope of escape. But in fact, God opens up a way of escape where no human foresight could have predicted one. There's no way that Moses' mother could have thought, well, Pharaoh's daughter is going to come along and she'll surely save my son. So it's this idea of miraculous rescue where no human insight could have provided a rescue, and both of them take place in these bodies of water. So you have these sort of parallel themes that are being set up. It's not a precise parallel, obviously, but it's sort of, these sorts of things sometimes seem like window dressing to us, but if you get to look at the way that the biblical writers were thinking, these connections are a lot more important to them, and they make them all the time. We see that in the New Testament as well. And we can sort of get a sense of this. By the way, Paul, say, uses the Old Testament, and what are the things that he thinks are striking and says, hey, because of this, therefore that. So what are the things that he's building on? And so then we can look back and say, what are other things that are similar to that that we should be paying attention to in the narrative? Abby.
I just had a question about, like, you shall not take the Lord or the name of the Lord your God in vain. I've always, like, as a kid growing up in church, I'd always take that, like, you can't say, oh, like, oh my G-O-D, you know, like, that was always how it was explained to me, like, growing up. And but I feel like it's probably much bigger than just that. And I was just curious, like, if you could go deeper on that.
Yes, first. Exactly. So I did. I spent most of a whole lesson on that, so I can't go into all of that. But here's the key. So the actual language, it's the idea not just of taking the name, but of bearing the name. So it's a word that normally means carrying something. And in fact, it's the same word that's used in conjunction with name in Numbers. I forget the exact reference, where it says that Aaron will bear the name of the children of Israel before the Lord. So the idea is the idea of, so bearing the name, we find this exact same language elsewhere in a book written by the same writer that makes it very clear. The idea of bearing the name has to do with representation and has to do with bearing the name of someone else and representing them before another. And so with that parallel in mind, then the bigger idea of bearing the name, certainly it would involve, you know, not, you know, using God's name as a curse word. That'd be a part of it, right? That's a tiny, tiny subsection of a much bigger theme. That is, we are to represent God before the world. Israel was to represent God before the world. And so when you start seeing that, it becomes this much really central idea of what it means to represent God publicly, that God's name has been placed upon them and they're to bear that with honor. And that's further supported by the fact that Paul talks about the name of God is blasphemed through you among the Gentiles. So this idea of the blaspheming of God's name, which would be the opposite of bearing God's name with honor, is a constant theme in the Old Testament prophets and one that's also picked up in the New Testament. So the idea that God's name is his public reputation and how we bear it is how we make others think about God. And that's the big idea. So certainly using God's name as a curse word would not make others think well of God. But it's much more than that. It's much broader than that. And it's actually what gives way. It's not just a policing rule about our speech that we have fewer expletives to use than others do. It's a much bigger concept about the whole purpose of our lives. Does that help? Brother Dean.
This is a this kind of a definition question. What's the difference between God's commandments, statutes, decrees, and laws? Can you break those apart?
I don't think those are the primary categories. So I think what you have in Exodus that it's broken into is you have the words and you have the judgments. And so you have the 10 words, what we would call the 10 commandments, but in Hebrew, it's the 10 words. And these are these general principles that apply in every situation. And then the judgments are breaking that down into the nitty gritty details of life and teaching us how to carry out those words in the practical realities of life. And so the words are more do this, don't do this, right? They're these absolute instructions and prohibitions, mostly prohibitions. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, apart from keeping the Sabbath and honoring your parents. Whereas the judgments are more like case law, like if this happens in this circumstance, do this. So that's the big distinction. What I would say, though, is that both the words and the judgments are part of the Old Covenant, and we are not under any of the Old Covenant. So there's sometimes it's divided. People will divide it into, you know, the moral law, the ceremonial law, and the civil law. That's not a division that's actually found in the text at all. Those are all jumbled together. The words and judgments is found, but they're all part of the Old Covenant. And Galatians, for example, makes very clear we're not under the Old Covenant. However, even though we are not under the, you know, Exodus 19 through 24 as a covenant, Exodus 19 through 24 remains a revelation of God's righteousness, and they continue to be God's word for us. So they teach us what God's righteousness looked like in that time and in that place. And we can, these words, as Paul says, they're written for our learning because we are still called. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And though we live under the new covenant, we are still called to pursue righteousness. And Jesus is a fuller revelation of the same righteousness that we find in the old covenant. And so what we are called to do when we read the old covenant, whether it be something as, you know, thou shalt not kill, or something as, you know, oddly specific as don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, we are called to do our best to discern what is the righteousness towards which that pointed in its context. How has the coming of Christ transformed our context? And so what does it look like for us to carry out that righteousness in our context? So those are the broader categories that I would work with. I don't think commandments, statute, those things. I think some of those, particularly in Psalm 119, David, if David is the one who wrote Psalm 119, he's using as many synonyms as possible. He's like stacking up every possible way of referring to God's law. But it's not necessarily particular words that are used to break up different categories of God's law. The only real division that you have within, say, the Old Covenant itself is that into words and judgments. I don't know, is that helpful? I know that went a little far afield from what you said, but it's sort of the context of the categories that we, I think, should be using in dealing with that topic. Noah.
So in the New Testament, it says that Legion possessed a man.
Mm-hmm.
Could Satan possess someone?
Ooh. Well, certainly, if you have a, you know, the idea, like, exactly what language to use to refer to demonic possession is a little bit tricky. And I'm not quite certain, how to answer that. But certainly, you have the idea that the man is controlled by demons. And so, if Satan is a demon, and demons can control people, then certainly Satan could control someone. And I think that's the idea of the Antichrist, that the Antichrist is that who, the one who's possessed by the spirit of Satan. And so exactly, is Satan, you know, possessing someone? It's really more the idea of someone is being oppressed and controlled by demons that is sort of the language that gets used there. And so certainly Satan does that in the case of the Antichrist, whose spirit is working as of the power of the evil one, I think it says in Thessalonians, maybe. And so that... I'd have to think some more about the details, but the big picture is that the Antichrist is controlled by Satan in exactly the way that you're suggesting. And in fact, that's why there are these many Antichrists who go out into the world, and there are Antichrists who show up in different, you know, there's like the final Antichrist, but there's also those who have the spirit of the Antichrist really in every age, and it's the one, you know, the person or the institution through whom Satan is working at that time. And so that would be, does that answer your question? I know it's a big topic, and I'd have to think some more about exactly how to phrase it. Elijah?
A reference question. I know that we're running through Kingdom Through Covenant, and it has good context for the covenants themselves, but what would you say is a good resource for... Old Testament context, like a historical context?
Ooh.
Is there one good, like, basic foundational one, I guess, is the question.
There's one book that I used in the School of Ministry. The title is escaping me, but it had, like, the color. I gave some printouts. There's not, like, one book. So I spent a long time looking for such a book. and I couldn't find like one that I really liked. This one that was out of print was the closest, where it sort of had like a chapter about the historical context, the geographical context. So that would be, which you can borrow that book from me. You can buy it used. I just don't remember the title. But if you ask me, there is a book that sort of is that. It's a little bit outdated now in terms of some of the, you know, archaeological stuff. But it still is the best thing that I've seen. There's another one that I haven't had a chance to evaluate yet that I have that would give some of that context. But of course, as you know, one of the problems is finding something that is accurate and up to date, but also, you know, not liberal. And so finding the right resource, there's a need. There's some better things for the New, there's some solid things for the New Testament. It's just, you know, the different areas of context are so vast that actually finding, you know, the right people to do all of those things can be pretty hard. On the Reliability of the Old Testament by Kenneth Kitchen is a good one too, though. So that might be one. I wouldn't agree with all of some of the dating things that he does, but it's a big survey. It's also a fun read. If you think that Gentry is sprightly, you should read Kitchen. He's even more fun. Anyone else? Anyone else? All right. Let's pray and be done. Father, I come before you. I thank you for this opportunity to have discussed your word. I pray you would give us new insight into the chapters of Exodus that follow. May you be glorified. May we be faithful. In Christ's name, amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.